You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, forever and always here in my individual capacity. And we're returning to our very extensive series on energy. And this week, energy came into focus once again in two respects. But let's start with the first one. Poland, a NATO ally, was attacked basically by an AI-powered drone swarm, which caused NATO nations to scramble to respond. Now, the way that AI is generated requires an unbelievable amount of power. By some estimates, 50% more than now. By other estimates, 300% more than what we're using right now. And separately on the issue of energy this week, President Trump has lost patience with the request of our European allies to impose oil sanctions on Russia when they are themselves continuing to buy Russian oil. And that's something we're going to get into a little bit more. But one thing that I have learned over the years is that the people who pay attention to these events most in the world are not always national security lawyers, but instead hedge fund operators and people who hedge energy. And they have to track everything all the time, since their livelihood and that of their clients' profit really depends entirely on them knowing everything at all times, being seers, and just always getting it right to the extent they can. So I thought, let's talk to friend of the cast, Elaine Levin, who hedges energy for Powerhouse, which is located in Georgetown. Hi, Elaine. I'm so glad you're back, since this is your bailiwick. She's fresh from the Women in Energy Conference again. They're women in energy, Elaine.
They sure are.
Yeah, and there are women behind this podcast. So let's just get right to it. How important are oil and gas right now to the U.S. economy?
They are always what powers our economy, no pun intended. I mean, one of the reasons that we have been such an economic powerhouse is we've had access to abundant oil and gas reserves. Oil touches everything, more and more natural gas as well, going from a heating fuel to electric generation. Now, as your intro said, into AI. So it really is what our economy runs on. It couldn't be more important.
Let's talk a little bit about what drives oil prices, because one of the concerns in the background always is if oil prices go up, so do grocery prices. So do the price of everything, including our jeans, anything with stretch, plastic. This could have massive reverberations through the economy. But let's talk for a minute about the economic indicators. We can start with big macros, if you want.
Sure. And I mean, look, when you're talking the big macros, you have on the production side, you have OPEC and OPEC Plus. Russia puts one of the big pluses in OPEC Plus. Then, of course, you have the non-OPEC nations, which continue to grow, led by the United States. Remember, the United States produces more oil and gas than the history of any country in the history of ever. Oil production dwarfs what is being produced out of Saudi Arabia or Russia. And we are also the biggest producer of natural gas. So that's the production side. Then you've got the demand side, which includes your developed countries, as well as your emerging markets that have been so important, say China and India. And the intersection of the two is where you get price. And that's where Powerhouse comes in. We spend our day looking at the impact of price and how to control the price of oil through financial instruments.
Let's talk about what has happened over the last decade and how that might have impacted our economic place in the world. Where were we on oil prices over the past decade, and what, if anything, changed to tip the balance?
Well, you know, I think we've seen the shale revolution and the U.S. just continue to lead in oil production. Of course, within the last decade, you had the pandemic, as well as Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So we've seen oil prices in a very short period of time go from bust, with oil turning negative. Believe it or not, oil prices can turn negative. We saw oil prices trade a negative $40 for a fast second and you say, well, how can oil prices turn negative? I like to think it's like, if you have a basement full of stuff, you call 1-800-GOT-JUNK and ask them to pay you to take your stuff away. It's almost exactly what the market was doing. Then, which also led to closures of refining, shut-ins of production. And then when we had the shock from Russia, who was such an important producer, especially to Europe for natural gas, we went to boom very fast and oil prices shot up to $130 in the U.S. And now we're looking at perhaps another round of busts, depending on how OPEC, which has been in the news, continues to add oil into the market and fight for their market share.
Let's talk a little bit about emerging markets and their sensitivity to price.
Oh, of course. Yes. The increase of China, their demand, has been so important. They have been really the source of new demand growth globally. And now we're looking at that flatlining to some degree, and India coming up and taking the reign as the new driver of new demand growth. But remember, these are emerging markets, and their job is to try to find the cheapest barrel out there. Oil is a fungible commodity. They're going to try to do what they can. And I don't think anybody can blame them for their own constituents to try to source barrels as cheap as possible. Just right now, that may not be from sources that the White House wants them to buy from, which, of course, we're talking about Russia.
Yeah. When President Trump came in, he said he wanted more oil production, but he also said a second piece of that, which is he wanted more refining of oil in the United States. You said we have a lot of oil and gas production. Do we have anything in terms of refining to meet that level of production?
That is an excellent question. And remember what I said, during the pandemic, we saw a lot of our refining get idled, and we've lost refining, particularly on the coast. On the East Coast, we saw refining shut, and on the West Coast, which is a whole other story. So we saw a contraction leading to about 2023. But as price expanded and we saw diesel prices north of $4, gasoline jump on the Russia-Ukraine news, we saw expansion of our refining in places like the Gulf, some degree in the Midwest. So we have started to build back some refining. The problem that we have is refining is not always growing where we need it. There's two refineries set to close in California, and they continue to lose refining, which makes them so much more dependent on imports, to the point where the California government is looking at ways to try to stave off the loss of some refining. They even just passed legislation to try to bring back oil production, because there again, their feedstocks coming somewhat from Alaska, but more and more they are dependent on imports at a time when we have so much of our own production.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time, and I don't know if it's still the case, but there was a time when you drive around LA and you could actually see rigs. But let's talk a little bit about the cartel situation. I mean, we hear about Brent crude, and just for a minute, kind of break that down. For years, we never heard of Brent crude. When did this happen? What is the other kind of crude? So when people look at these market prices, how does that affect us?
It's the European benchmark is the best way to think about it. And Brent crude is traded for a long time, but it depends on what's going on in the world. Our crude is WTI, West Texas Intermediate, which is a light sweet crude. You've got Brent crude, which is really the price that Europe pays. And there's an arbitrage, you know, as people look at the different crude prices. I mean, there are other benchmarks as well. But to your point about the cartels, I want to go back to that for a moment. Remember, the U.S. has just been bringing their production up to record amounts. I mean, we're knocking on the door of 14 million barrels a day. So Saudis and OPEC have made the determination in 2022 that they would rather support oil prices by voluntarily cutting production. And that was OPEC and OPEC Plus. We've seen OPEC and OPEC Plus quickly unwind those voluntary cuts. And there's two tranches of them. The first tranche was unwound a year ahead of schedule. We just saw a meeting about a week ago where they're starting to chip away at the second tranche. But it's very clear two things. One, I think there's no coincidence that when Trump came into office, his first scheduled trip, the Pope's funeral aside, was to Saudi Arabia. Second, remember, you said Trump, when he came into office, said he wanted to increase more oil, that drill, baby, drill. Well, we don't have a king, at least yet. And we don't have national oil companies. We still have a capitalist system. And the oil companies will make the determination if the price is right for them to drill. So as prices have started to drift lower, we've seen our rig counts start to fall. We've seen activity in the oil patch start to contract. And I believe that OPEC's looking at this as an opportunity for them to start reclaiming some market share that they had given up to support price.
Okay. And then you mentioned the OPEC and OPEC Plus. The plus was what?
The big plus, which are the non-OPEC countries that said, hey, we're going to go along with OPEC to help support price. And the biggest, most important of the plus was Russia. Now, Russia's output has started to drop as Ukraine has done a number on their refineries. There's also been sanctions, although there is that shadow fleet. But it is the cooperation of Russia, as well as some other non-OPEC nations, to help support the price in times when we've seen lower oil prices.
This gets to the issue of there was a time when we had a massive crisis, not just here, because there was queuing in Europe as well. But let's talk about the oil shock of the 70s. What precipitated that? And sort of how did it unwind? But I guess I wonder what's different now, if we can distinguish sort of the environment at that time from this moment.
Yes. Well, remember, we did not have the production that we did at that time. I remember my parents, the even odd days, and there's some history there, of course, with the Arab oil embargo. What happened as a result was it was actually illegal to ship oil outside of really North America as a result of that time. We just did not have the production that we do now. And we were completely dependent on those Arab nations who decided that they weren't going to send their oil. We also had another shock, of course, when the Shah was overthrown. It really wasn't until the shale revolution and the Obama administration, when the laws were changed that we were allowed to now export oil off of our shores. You know, you'd say, build it and they will come. Well, there was no better signal to the U.S. oil producers that if they could get away from just a North American and mostly domestic market and bring their oil to the world, well, that's really what supercharged the change. And why we really, as I said in our last podcast, which was during the pandemic, the idea that North American oil independence and energy independence was really a reality, a huge shift from what we had seen decades before.
You know, one of the things that you have said over and over again is that oil prices and so on don't really care who's president. But it is interesting that it was during the Obama administration that the regulations were changed and the laws were changed such that shale production could really fire up in earnest. Did I get that right?
Yes, that is correct. And really, there is no correlation. If you look at the history of what party's sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to what our oil production is, the shale revolution, which was a technology change, that really started it. But the changing of the law, which was a Democrat, which most people kind of forget, was what really started to supercharge the production in the United States. And then, of course, when Trump 1.0 came in, that continued. Oil production fell during the pandemic, of course. And under Biden, we hit some new highs, and we're doing that now under Trump 2.0, although that's starting to top out, which goes back to my previous statement that the price isn't as supportive for our producers, which is by design of the Trump administration, because he has made the promise that he wants to get oil prices down. And we have seen prices fall during his second administration. Some of it has to do with tariffs. Some of it, like I said, has to do with OPEC and their change in, rather than being a supporter of price, they're looking to get market share back. You know, I believe that one of the reasons Trump is so interested in getting prices down starts with your first statement. If you could get oil prices down, that's very helpful to work against inflation. If you could get inflation down, it makes room for any price increases from the tariffs. He also needs the tariffs to bring in revenue to help offset the deficits. And if you can get the deficits down, well, that carves room for tax increases, which was also one of his promises of his campaign.
Tax decreases, right?
I'm sorry, tax decreases.
I think he promised the opposite. I mean, I find this interesting, but then I want to get back to this refining thing. Let's assume we're going to, you know, we're going to do as much production as we can. Is refining play a role in price and our capacity to refine? How does our refining infrastructure impact price?
It's a good question in that we do not fly a plane on crude oil. We do not put crude oil in our car. So it's the ability to take crude oil and break it into its products. If you really want to see what's happening, watching the products, which the two important ones are diesel and gasoline, and what the refiner will get for turning that barrel of crude into those products is what is so important. So, for example, coming into this year, we had a colder winter. We've seen distillate, which is diesel and jet fuel. They're all part of the same cut of the crude oil barrel. Those stocks had fallen. They had never really rebuilt after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And so the refiners were incented by the price of diesel versus the price of crude oil to try to produce as much diesel and jet fuel as they could. Now, you can't make diesel without making gasoline, but we've seen the refiners trying to maximize what they'd say that distillate output, because it was really the one commodity that had been tight coming into 2025. And still, as we're looking forward to winter coming, the stocks have improved both here and in Europe, but they're still not to levels that give everyone that's watching markets as much comfort. That's the other problem that we're looking at going into the winter. Remember, if Europe doesn't get their products from Russia, and we have, once again, oil, diesel, all of it trades throughout the world, you don't ever want to see a point where it's cold here and cold in Europe and there's a bidding war for diesel and it starts to tighten the supplies here in the United States, particularly on the East Coast.
When you talk about all this production and everybody talks about drill, baby, drill and shale, you know, there was that book, right? Twilight in the Desert.
Yes.
Which predicted the world running out of oil. I mean, it is fossil fuels. It's dead dinosaurs and bugs, right? Oh. Leaves and whatever from before the Ice Age. So what prevents that from running out?
Technology has been our friend in all of this. And technology solves a lot of woes. And we've been able to recover natural gas and crude oil from places that we didn't think we'd be able to if we had thought in the 1970s, even though fracking's an older technology, but just doing it at the scale that we have now. I mean, these wells will mature, but there are other places that are also finding more and more oil. Look at what's going on in Canada. And as they increase their export capacity out of new pipelines going off the West Coast, we've seen their production increase. Brazil is a huge story for this year, and that has really surprised to the upside. There's oil in places in Africa. There are other places around the world that are now starting to look at fracking technology that haven't before. So it's kind of funny. The talk has gone from peak oil supply to peak oil demand. And the International Energy Agency, that was something they were looking at as we were seeing more use of renewables. Well, with AI coming into play, oil's had a stay of execution from all the agencies, your letters, because, and look at what I just said was going on in California. You know, it's coming very, very clear that this is not the energy transition, but the energy addition. We're going to need it all.
Yeah, I just hope we can figure out something to do with all the carbon. I hope that's the technology that we develop. And I hope we can beat every other country, because I think we'll rule the world for sure at that point. When you're hedging, though, you know, we're watching this whole tariffs thing. And just last week, we did a podcast on for appeals for the Court of Federal Claims on the VOS case. It was a discussion on the tariffs. It's going to the Supreme Court. But what I wonder is, when you're hedging, how do tariffs figure into your calculus?
I like to think of diesel as the fuel of economic activity. We use it to power our planes and jet fuel, which is a sister fuel, if you will. We use it to move goods. We use it to build. So watching what happens with the tariffs and its impact on things, there's been some statistics that the sale of cardboard boxes is down to levels we haven't seen for years. Well, if you're not moving things around, you don't need to put them in a box. I have a cousin who's married to a gentleman who has a forklift business, and I asked him how business was going, and he's seen a contraction, because if you're not putting stuff in a box and shipping it, then you don't need a forklift on the other end to move right. It around. So this is the issue. We're starting to see a contraction in the movement of goods. And it will ultimately impact the demand for diesel. So we'll see what happens. The Fed's going to meet this week. We know that there's most likely going to be an interest rate cut, is at least what the markets are pointing at. So we'll have to see what kind of life that breathes into the market. But the tariffs themselves, as it stands right now, are starting to contract some of that activity. People just aren't buying and moving as many goods as they were.
I did hear some statements from the guy who runs the Port of San Pedro in LA, you know, one of the biggest shipping container areas. And he was talking about the lack of shipping that's coming in compared to where we were, 18 months ago. Let's go back for a second. You said something earlier, and I kind of wanted to get back and have you sort of state it again in answer to a separate question. The president, as a political matter, and I mean any president, would want lower or higher gas prices. Why? Let's just state the obvious.
Yeah, just because lower gas prices are seen as a tax cut, in effect. You know, it puts sure. more money into the hands of consumers to do other things with. So if you can get energy prices down, it makes it easier for families who need to pay for gasoline to put in their cars. It makes it easier for businesses that need to fuel trucks, for airlines that need to fuel planes. That's why every president wants to see prices down. I mean, look at Biden. When he was in office, he turned a blind eye to Iran and Russia to a big degree, because he knew the impact if he didn't, and the prices were already moving up pretty sharply when Russia went into Ukraine. You know, he couldn't afford to see that go more than it did. So I think Trump is very aware that he wants to get prices down. I think that's one of the reasons he's working so hard to try to see an end to the war between Russia and Ukraine. I think he would also like to see things settle down in Israel and Gaza and get an end to that as well. I think the more he can take energy hotspots out of the equation and return to business as usual, I think the happier he would be.
And, you know, I think I asked you this question when we've talked before, but what impact do politics and political parties, as a practical matter, have on these prices?
You know, once again, there's not the correlation you would think. Now, of course, everyone knows that the Republicans will be more pro-oil than the Democrats. But as far as the history is concerned, at least recent history, we have seen with changes in laws, the ability of exports and the ability of free trade also is important. That's one thing that we're seeing right now in natural gas. And one thing that I think that President Trump is going to work very hard is to fast track a lot of our NGL, our LNG exports, trying to get those facilities up and running as fast as we can so we can get our gas out to the world. And there's a world that wants to buy liquefied natural gas from us. So as far as permitting, things like that, you do tend to see the Republicans try to push that harder. But it also depends on what's going on in the world and what the price of oil is. Because in the end, ultimately, it is price that matters to a producer.
Yeah. And I mean, I think if global prices go down too far, now correct me if I'm wrong, but I've listened to a lot of people discussing the potential impact on Russia, which is it would hurt them economically for sure. But the second issue is if you hurt them too much, then, you know, they may latch on to yet another dictator because it is that milieu of poverty and distress that often makes a strong man more attractive to what is, you know, a desperate population. But let's go back for a second, because we've seen that the leaders of the countries, India, China, Russia, and even North Korea all met, you know, last week. And according to all news reports, much of the discussion was on the topic of energy. What was your take on that? And what, if any, impact out of that we might expect, other than maybe more demand from?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it was a signal that Russia said, and China and India right back saying, as long as we can, let's keep this train going. And it'll be up to the United States and their allies to see what kind of pressure they can put on Russia, if indeed Trump is serious in trying to get Putin to the negotiating table. I think that has been a harder ask than, I mean, he said as much. You know, Putin's a tough cookie. And so he's losing patience because he wants to get this deal. Because if you notice in his statement, he also said that if we can get an end to this war, open the floodgates, Russia, you know, have at it. I think he's doing a carrot and stick here, trying to say we can put the pressure on you, but also if we can come to an end, it would serve everyone to try to open up the taps freely to get oil prices down, which of course is one of Trump's campaign promises.
My personal opinion is that that meeting was assigned back to Trump, that, you know, cut us off, have Europe tariff us, stop buying our oil. We'll just turn to China and India because they have an unlimited capacity to absorb our product and to purchase it. I mean, that was definitely the signal that I got from that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with that. And they just wanted to show a sign of solidarity.
So let's go on to the recent legislation, though, the one big, beautiful bill. So what were sort of the things that might affect pricing, and what were the energy takeaways that you, as someone who is counseling on investment and hedging, what were the things you focused on?
One thing that we did see, I mean, there was a lot of concessions as far as relaxing of regulations. We also saw a relaxing, for example, of the CAFE standard. So that's gone for the most part.
Why don't you talk about what those are?
There were rules on the miles per hour that a car needed to get as we tried to push efficiencies. There were also other efficiency programs, Energy Star, other things. The big, beautiful bill said, no, we don't need to be as efficient. We need to use our oil and gas. We need to sell it. There was also some big switches in some of the bio and environmental products out there. Wind and solar lost their standings from some of the previous legislation. some of the things that we've been watching. When Biden was in office, one thing that he really wanted to push was something called sustainable aviation fuel, which was basically a biofuel. And if you looked at some of the credit programs, they were really built to try to push more production of this sustainable aviation fuel. Now, we do not have a mandate. There is a mandate for a small percentage in Europe. The big, beautiful bill basically took the thumb off the scale in favor of sustainable aviation fuel for more traditional ethanol and renewable diesel. But we're still watching some of these credit programs play out. There's something called a small refinery exemption. We're still watching that. There was some reporting in Reuters this week about there could be some changes. Remember, some of these programs, they're basically the subsidies, renewable identification numbers, some of these credit programs on the federal level, they are the subsidies that are needed to give ethanol and renewable diesel the even playing field. But if they start to go up and bring prices at the pump through higher ethanol prices, or bring prices of biodiesel and renewable diesel up, it'll be interesting to see the reaction of the administration going back to the overarching theme of they want to get prices down. So they do still have some levers that they can pull.
This AI energy need, it's either going to be 50% more of what we need right now, or, you know, some estimates are as much as 300%. How does sort of the growth of AI figure into your analysis, or does it? I mean, are you looking at markers or indicators to see how AI in and of itself, regardless of government policy, is going to impact price?
We're starting to see it. As you know, we're here in Washington, D.C. So in our own backyard, we've started to see Data Center Alley start to put some strains on our local grid. But what's very interesting is it's had on these knock-on effects. I mean, would you ever think in your lifetime that we'd ever see Three Mile Island come back in life? You know,
definitely not, Elaine.
Yeah. So, you know, the talk of nuclear is coming back into the conversation. It's also having impact on who's going to pay for some of these elevated rates. And it's changing the idea of, there was a lot of states, particularly blue states, that were looking at the electrification of everything. Well, now the calculus is changing on that, because electricity, which we've seen so many efficiency gains for so many years, now all of a sudden we're seeing this new demand come rushing into the grid, and it started to have material effects onto the price of electricity. There's one thing that we haven't really talked about, which is the need for infrastructure. If you want to know what our Achilles heel, despite having all this wonderful, abundant oil and natural gas in the country, we need the infrastructure to deliver it, whether it's transmission lines, pipelines. And I know that that is also a priority of this administration, to try to fast track some of this, because it has been a not in my backyard situation. I mean, you see that story again and again and again, but the Achilles heel, if you ask me, is trying to develop that infrastructure, because we're going to need it if AI does even a part of what the predictions are. Now, once again, technology is a wonderful thing, and high price is the best cure for high price. So when things move, people figure out very quickly how to take advantage of it. But the jury is still out, and some of these energy companies are looking, because remember, there had been some false starts before, you know, were we going to need to build out more generation for EVs? Well, that really didn't come to play. And so they need to be careful, because there are large CapEx expenditures that they will need to meet this growing demand. If it comes to the degree that some of those higher estimates are looking at, but to be continued. But as it stands right now, there is an arms race. There's no question about it, to try to build this out.
Yeah, and I think we've made sort of a lot of threats slash promises about how we're going to approach AI publicly. There are already stories about, you know, an elementary school somewhere that didn't have access to the same amount of water. They were having water problems because of some of these data centers that right. popped up, I think, somewhere along I-81, which is, you know, you notice they're just forever. And it's funny you call that. What did you call it again? Data Center Alley?
Yes.
Wow.
And you know, it also shows that, you know, a lot of this will be fossil fuel driven. It's going to be natural gas for a generation. You're going to see generation actually existing at the data centers. There's talk of these small modular nuclear that we hadn't talked about before. I mean, I think that's going to take some time. But you also, we know from our own customer base that a lot of these data centers, they can't go down. It's very expensive. So they need backup generation. And a lot right. of time that generation could be good old fashioned diesel, even though I think they'd like renewable diesel, but we just don't have enough of it. It all goes to California. So it's been fascinating to watch. We are already starting to see the impact as far as reliability on the grid, as far as what we're going to need, as far as that infrastructure. And it's a very interesting time to see if we're going to be up to that challenge. But once again, high price cures a lot of woes. But I just mm-hmm. think people are trying to avoid the price going higher if they can.
It's always very interesting to talk to you about this stuff because it has so little to do with politics. But in my view, it has so much to do with our national security, and it always will.
You're exactly right. And, you know, the other thing is, of course, politics come into it. I mean, there's a reason the oil and gas industry tends to vote Republican. There's a reason that environmentalists tend to go Democrat. So there are those overlays. But I think one thing that should unite us is that we are this powerhouse, no pun intended, of oil and gas production. We have these bountiful resources, and how we deploy them will continue to add to our prosperity as a country. And that's what's exciting.
Elaine, it's been great to talk to you tonight. Our guest has been Elaine Levin of Powerhouse, which is an energy hedge. It's a company in Georgetown.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's always fun.
Well, and thank you for listening to National Security Law Today. Be sure to hit the subscribe button on your listening app of choice. We would ask you to share this episode with a friend. And when you do, have a civil discussion about the facts, the law, even things like energy. Whatever your views may be, it might be important to understand things like market analysis and trends that may kind of defeat any of our worldviews, no matter what we do. And just remember, despite everything that has happened in the last week, it's important to remember that we still live in a country with more diversity of thought than any other. And our ability to work through those differences and have national unity is part of what gives us our national security. So our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. The other wonderful women of NSLT include my co-producer, Holly McMahon, our program manager, Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney, our editor and my co-producer, Francis Burkham. We get social media and research support from Alana Coopersmith. And we acknowledge the contribution of the amazing and brilliant members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. And we will be continuing a little bit more discussion of national security and energy.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.